I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another High Resolution. I'm Seamus Byrne. Today we're talking to one of the world leading virtual reality free roaming experiences out there, Zero Latency. I'm talking to the CEO, Tim Ruse, one of the co-founders of the whole operation. And it started here in Australia. It started down in Melbourne back in 2015. They have since opened 46 locations across the world. And here in Australia, they have locations in Melbourne, Perth, Gold Coast, and Brisbane. And just this month, they have launched their first venue in Sydney. So it seemed like a good excuse to catch up with Tim and talk about the whole history of this kind of VR experience. You know, I think when we think about VR, we think about buying our own kit a lot. We think about sort of the setup or sitting at a desk. This is a very different experience where you wear a backpack, you have a free roaming capability, you're not sort of tethered to a cable, and you can work in a group. So it's really unique, and it's a big part of why they've had such success. They've had lots of the major PC hardware companies work with them in order to tailor these things and get it working well. It's a really cool story. And so we do geek out on a lot of the technical details of getting VR to work well in this sort of context, the things they've learned along the way, what they think about the entire virtual reality space as well, and how they see that evolving and what the challenges are for the future in this area. So really interesting chat. Tim is lovely and really, really great personality. So a really fascinating chat and clearly somebody who knows so much about how to make VR work really successfully. So sit back for the next half an hour and enjoy my chat with Tim Ruse, the CEO of Zero Latency. Look, let's jump back to the beginning to kind of kick it off. You know, what was kind of that starting moment? How long ago was it now when you sort of first thought, hey, let's actually try this crazy thing?
Yeah, so we I guess that sort of light bulb moment or that genesis of the project was in around sort of late 2012, early 2013, when the Oculus Rift had just come out. And the full sort of slightly more wacky tangent was that there was a thing, I don't know if you remember it being a Sydney slider, there was an IRL shooter game called Patient Zero where they got like laser tag guns, actors. It was this really successful crowdfunding campaign. They raised like a bunch of money. But the execution was difficult because you can imagine trying to wrangle 30 actors, makeup. Like, it was a very ambitious project. And my co-founder had gone and played it and the Oculus Rift had been announced. And we were working together at the time and Scott came in and said, look, I play this game, but had all these issues. Wouldn't it be awesome if you could do a similar thing, but in VR? I reckon we've got an outline, the sort of technology that he was envisaging. And I was like, man, that's an awesome idea. It sounds like a sort of childhood nerd fantasy of mine. Let's get it done. And that just became an obsession, to be honest. We worked on it, in our spare time. Scott put a lot of hours in getting the initial prototypes up and running, Keel as well. And then it was kind of showtime. So being the business guy of the partnership back then, it was just three of us, did a crowdfunding campaign, did some public demos, which was really good. And then got the crowdfunding up and running. That was good. We raised like 32 grand, of which I think six gets taken by various people. And we're like, oh, wow, this is going to be a lot more expensive than we thought it was. And luckily we got the attention through that process of some venture capital guys in Sydney, Carthona Capital, who gave us our first check. And off we went, and the rest has been sort of, that was in 20, so in 2015 we went pro, as we like to say. We went full time on it, and it's been a really, really busy 5 years since then.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And so look, yeah, I mean, again, if like being 5 years, the tech itself sort of keeps evolving, you know, how much work do you need to do to sort of refresh the setup, like thinking about maybe that, you know, the first venue in Melbourne, you've sort of now got a sort of a whole bunch of other venues in other cities as well. But you know, for that first location, at what points do you think, oh, you know, it's time to get new headsets, it's time to get the new, you know, a next generation bunch of backpacks, you know, all the kinds of tech that you're using in order to sort of keep that experience, I guess, as high end as possible?
Yeah, well, the first one that we put together was backpacks from like the local computer store inside backpacks. We then got a seamstress that did cosplay stuff to like make them out of canvas.
Brilliant.
Spoilers, canvas holds sweat. So that was a disaster and they had to all get thrown away. And then luckily we actually found a Alienware Steambox computer that, because there was no backpacks back then, and they were just so unreliable. We're like, oh man, we're just going to be in a world of hurt with these cobbled together things. If anyone knocks into them, they're running like half remote control aeroplane technology with computer technology, like VR headset, these ping pong balls stuck on the top. We were butchering PlayStation Move controllers to get the balls. So So there was all this crazy cobbled together technology. And then we put all these USB PlayStation cameras in the roof. Doesn't use PlayStation technology, but it was the best version that we could get with our proprietary tracking technology that sits underneath it doing optical tracking. We used to have computers in the roof, 8 USB cameras, but then they all started to pop. Like the CPUs would go in them one after the other because they're just being flogged. And yeah, you know, so we realize that when it says on a consumer grade product, it can do X, that's not true because no one ever makes it do X. Don't go close to X. So then we had to do a full refresh, like IP cameras, which was good, and then centralize it all into a server rack. And that was kind of our version one product that we ended up selling into our first real, like, outside of Australia site, into Sega in Japan, which was awesome, into the Joyopolis there. It's the trick. You're always in a balancing act between wanting to use the latest technology but also waiting for it to be in prime time.
Yeah.
And you need to give yourself some time to stress test it in your R&D lab because it's a trend. People say, oh, it does this. When you put it under pressure, it doesn't always do what it says on the box. And then you've got to be able to operationalize it. And I think that's part of the what we've done really well as a business, but part of the business challenge is how do you operationalize this technology in a way that the operator can operate on the other side of the world. And that's the hard bit of scaling out a business like this. So we've moved on to our Gen 2 technology, which is using Windows Mixed Reality Suite. Just been a really eye-opening experience working with them, working with HP. We had a bit of a nerd honor of them releasing a patch for Windows specifically for us, which was nice. It was that was a nice moment when Microsoft did that for us to just unlock some features in Windows Mixed Reality. But what's been really fascinating working with those companies is like working with Alienware back in the day. They're like, oh, you think you can use our computers in a backpack? We're like, yeah, we're just going to like get some batteries and punch them in and make our own control box. And they're like, well, we never thought of using that. And then the same with Windows Mixed Reality. They never really thought about multiple people in a space using it at large scale. We did a bunch of testing and said, look, if you can make these changes, like we're very confident that it will work. And it's been an awesome tracking solution. And I think that's been a big jump, having local tracking. It's just so much more responsive. It's faster. It's easier to, once it's locked into the SLAM tracking and it knows where it is, it's really rock solid and takes that gaming to the next level. Because the thing about a free roam, I guess any VR experience, is pretty unforgiving. If the frame rate drops, if your tracking lags, if it's off center, it's a nausea inducing disaster zone. So you've got to get a lot of things working right. And it's been good to go, okay, we've got this great bespoke tracking technology, but it has some limitations. Let's use this new one, which actually also allows you to have it in a slightly smaller space, which is cool because you're constantly battling, delivering an amazing experience. But what operators want is the smallest footprint possible because that's how you make money.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, I mean, let's nerd out a little bit more on the whole free roam kind of system because clearly it's hard. You know, if it wasn't hard, there'd probably be a lot more of them out there. So, you know, how is it now working? You know, so you talked about all the cameras and things. Like, is it still externally tracked, or is it kind of inside out at this point, or sort of exactly what kind of a setup is it?
It's inside our new technology, which is almost 2 years old now, but new for us is all SLAM based inside out tracking.
Right.
So it's which is good. Definitely a better solution. I mean, everything has its pros and cons.
Yeah.
Like it has its limitations, but it's very good in terms of operational efficiency and just that because it's rendering locally versus like outside in is where you put it through the entire server and back. It's pretty seamless. But what you're playing now is you're actually seeing your gun rotation, your head rotation all happening in a local loop, which just adds that, you know, you're getting a lot, just that little bit faster, which just makes it feel a lot more fluid. Plus the resolution is, I think, effectively almost three times higher than our headsets because you've got more pixels, the screen's a better quality, the screen dooring is completely gone on the new Reverb headsets and not even the G2s, which are better again. And that as you start to peel off the layers, like, oh, now the tracking feels like I can move my gun really fast and you don't start to see the gaps.
Yeah.
Whereas if before you could move really quickly and go, oh, okay, you're not, you're only tracking X amount of frames, whereas now that's super fluid. There's no screen door. You can acquire a target because we make shooters more like 50 virtual meters versus 15 before it starts to fuzz out. It just increases what you can do. Like working with the Far Cry franchise, you can now stand at the start of the game and look out over like a Far Cry certified vista, the birds flying off. It's really cool. Yeah. And it just, it's not all about graphics, but it certainly helps. It certainly helps having that high fidelity, I think, to just root people in the experience really, really firmly.
Yeah. And so Sydney is about to open. I think the listing says it's the sixth location. Is that just the sixth here in Australia or?
Yes, sixth here in Australia. We're going to have 50 open by the end of the year all over the world, which is exciting. Yeah. So even COVID can't stop the train, slow the train down a little, but still moving forwards with that, which is awesome. And yeah, Sydney's almost ready to go. I just got a few photos in before of the paint going down and all the signage going up. So it's exciting.
Nice. So, I mean, when we put it at the 50th, is this like an indictment on Sydney's real estate market, the fact that it's taken this long to make it to Sydney? Yeah. Is it about finding the right place?
It's a combination of, I think one of the, there's advantages to being at the front of something.
Yeah.
There's also disadvantages. And this is a disadvantage that when you go to explain it to somebody, they're like, oh, is it like a time zone? You're like, not really.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's more closer to a time zone than a TV repair shop you can't operate in this jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So that's been an issue.
Yeah, right.
But we've got a good venue now, which is it's really exciting. Really excited to get it to Sydney because we've got a lot of investors up there, tech media is up there. It's been our white whale, Sydney, for some time. Almost, and then no, it's collapsed. So that's when we signed the lease and then COVID happened, we're like, oh, you've got to be joking. I'm not saying we caused COVID. I'm not a superstitious man, but I could say the timing was weird. But now it's all systems go. And the really great thing, we're seeing it in the Gold Coast and Brisbane, because they've been open for quite some time. People are back. Like once the specter of COVID has lifted a little bit, people are back. And it's a really fun activity that like we actually social distanced our content, which was an interesting experience. We already have like alarms that stop you from hurting each other. So we're like, well, hang on a moment, can't we just extend those out? So it's safe in that regard.
Yeah.
We're already pretty like retentive about hygiene because you don't like no one wants to put on a dirty headset. I don't want to put on a dirty headset. I don't want you to put on a dirty headset. So we've always had a very rigorous hygiene regime, which has actually set us in good stead for this. So it feels like it's always the right time for zero latency, but it's interesting to see like competitor concepts that really struggle in this kind of new normal, which could be here for some time. Whereas this is a small experience, like it's small groups, really hygienic. You don't even need to see another group. It's all, we can clean all the gear thoroughly in between sessions. Plus there's eight people in a 200 or 300 square meter space. So, I think we're seeing that even in Melbourne, that some cracked its second wave after its lockdown. We're seeing a really big resurgence of people wanting to come out of their homes and play, which is awesome.
Yeah. And, how does the kind of the business model work in the end, you know, that is there that element of, you know, do you see people sort of coming back on a regular basis or is it like, it's funny that when it first launched, it didn't like, I don't know. It feels like to me, escape rooms kind of are now a more, loud and proud thing as well. And when this first launched, it wasn't even that parallel to it. Whereas now there's sort of a bit of a parallel sense of it's like, you know, this virtual reality experience that I guess is a similar go out and have a small group of people together and have this sort of experience. I think escape rooms aren't necessarily all that replayable in a sense once you've solved all the problems. So, how do you feel like that sort of idea of people kind of coming back to play again or just kind of attracting new people to it is?
Yeah, look, the biggest driver for us is word of mouth. So delivering good experience begets more customers, which is really critical. It's almost like 60 to 70% of people say they heard about us first through a friend or on social media. So that's a really big part of it. But your marketing mix all sort of mashes together into a bit of a soup, but it's a really critical component. People coming back with friends and different friends is an interesting trend that we see. But a lot of people, it's occasion-based, which is something that we're looking at. How do we shift that? You know, they come, it's not something you do every Tuesday night like you might play indoor cricket or whatever. It's something that you come for a special occasion to bring your friends together. So we're looking at ways that we can make that even more like seamless and affordable to come back in groups. But what's also really interesting, this is all over the world because we've got them in all different demographics, and it's interesting to sort of see over about 1.5 million games play globally now, trends. And one of the trends is that we have in each city this group of kind of Uber players that will come back 5 or more times. And that's getting rid of game masters accounts, like stripping all that out. It's like looking at how do we harness those people to be real advocates for the brand, which they already are, but it's interesting to see it really capture some people's imagination and they'll keep coming back at whatever price, which is cool.
Yeah. And is there scorekeeping and things like that in this? I mean, I guess, it might be worth trying to describe what's that experience for a set of players that would give it that element of replayability.
So we've got a spread of games that we have at different sites, and different sites would use different mixes depending on where they are in their launch cycle. But you get a score, and the scores are a lot more important than they thought they would be, to be honest. Like it's something, you know, the competitive aspect is important for people. So making that transparency of scoring has been critical. It used to be a little opaque. Now people want to come and go, right, what's a headshot worth? What's a body shot? How do I win? So that's, you get that element so you can improve on your game. And we also have a game called Soul Raiders, which is a PvP concept, which is very, very popular with repeat players. But one of the downsides of that is when you're part of a group playing collectively, like, yes, you can have how big was my score contest with other players, but you can also just participate, be part of the squad. It's very different when you're being eviscerated by the other team. So it's interesting the nature of, like, all our games before our Soul Raiders player versus player game, you could never really lose. You would always complete them. It was about your score. But I think it attracts different people. Some people are really, they want to just get in there and, try to best their friends in a player versus player scenario, but it'd also be quite confronting if you're being held down your spawn point.
You're right. It's like, one thing if you're just sitting in front of a screen having that happen to you when you're completely immersed in your destruction.
Doing the physical walk of shame back to your respawn point all the time. But we can, and we also have we have games that are completely non-shooter games. They're somewhere between a puzzle game and an experience. You essentially have to walk through the space together. But what we've done with those, called Engineerium, is it's kind of like an MC Escher world meets an Aztec temple. So you're doing some really crazy, like moving platforms, walking up walls, which is almost as impactful because it's taking you out of your physical comfort zone. Yeah. So as opposed to being like under pressure from being attacked and having to defend yourself, you get people's adrenaline up just by saying, okay, I want you to walk up this ramp. I want you to walk around this corkscrew. I want you to take these risks that you wouldn't take in real life. And even though people know in here that the floor is flat and that it's safe, it's interesting to see people go, oh man, I can't, I don't feel I can do that. And that's, it's when you sort of see the power of it. I think when you get rational people, they know it's a trick, but they're like, oh man, I need to take, I can't, I have to like be led through it by somebody. Not everybody. Like when you take someone that's got a really deep fear of heights after about 7 or 8 minutes into the game, where I think they enter this weird state where they forget, they know they're in a game, but it's so real that they're kind of remapping their reality, and you put them on a high bridge. If you've got a bona fide, like clinical fear of heights, like, you know, people will just lock up, and sometimes a game master has to get out and go, it's cool, man. Like, just shut your eyes and I'll walk you to safety and it's all going to be good. Yeah, it's quite powerful.
Well, it's fine. I mean, there's definitely research out there around sort of the use of VR to help people overcome sort of different fears, right?
Because
it's very real while knowing it's not real. And if someone can still engage with it in the right way, then it's actually going to help them. So that's kind of a really awesome thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of potential there, I think.
Yeah. And so then I guess as a business, is the overarching thing then about sort of just, opening more of these sorts of centers and things to kind of create that network effect? And do you own them all, or are they kind of franchised out?
Yeah, it's a franchise style model. We have licensed partners in regions, essentially, that sort of city by city. We don't want to put too many in one city at once, sort of testing the boundaries. We own or have a stake in 6 of them at the moment, which is good. And it, like, one in Vegas, one in Sydney, one in Melbourne, a couple in Melbourne now, one in Queensland. But the majority of them are operated by other operators, which is a risk, but also a real advantage, because it's hard to have a big footprint globally as a small company. Like, you got to pick your battles.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Are there different markets you've kind of seen respond in different ways, or is there any particular place that is, like, is working particularly well that, stands out?
Yeah, interesting question. I think it often comes down to which we've actually now doing a lot of work to give them a even more sophisticated pack, good operators with good marketing ability. Because we give them the technology, we give them the playbook on how to operate it, we give them the booking engine, we give them analytics, but being someone that knows how to manage a P&L well and understands how to market is critical. We're actually, as part of our service, because we take a fee ongoing, we are now getting marketing campaigns, testing on our own sites, getting other information. So we are starting to see a network effect of, we understand what works, we can test a lot of different concepts in different markets, and then see what works, be able to push that out to all the stores. Which is really, really helpful.
Mm. And so, how exciting is the idea of a Ubisoft partnership around Far Cry? I mean, that's kind of, I guess it's one thing to have, did you sort of develop your own games through those kind of first few, or work with developers? And then I guess it's then a whole different thing when someone says, here, like, let's do a collaboration like that.
Yeah, so we made all our own games initially, up until Far Cry. So we've got another game that's coming out soon with another third party, called Mission Maybe, which would be cool. It's more for kids. They built it, and that was a game they built for a free roam system that we essentially bought onto our platform. Cool. Whereas Far Cry is the first ever ground up build with a third party, and a big company, big developer, a big IP. So there's pressure on all ends to make it work. But it's been a really good experience. I think one thing about Ubisoft that really caught my attention when we were speaking to them and a couple of other different larger companies, and also movie studios, we're looking at, do we bring a movie IP in? Do we, like, bring a gaming IP? Like, I feel like we love people to have agency, and it feels more like an interactive experience. I don't want it to feel like a theme park ride. I want it to feel like you're inside a world. And that's where games won out. But also speaking to Ubisoft as a company, I think are quite unusual compared to their peers, where they really want to do new stuff. They've got a real, I don't know if it's a European aspect of it, but they have this real, like, we want to experiment. Like, we don't just want to keep cranking the handle. They crank a lot of handles, but they've also got this really deep vein of research and experimentation and trying things out, which is really cool, which is what you want in these games, because you need someone to come in and go, right, you've got a franchise. We respect that you understand that franchise, but we also have this new medium, which is pretty fresh, and there's things that work and things that don't, and you need to have that collaboration where they're bringing what they understand, which is making amazing games, and we're bringing what we understand, which is how to make a great free roam experience. Because unlike a game where you might spend, depending on who you are, but tens if not hundreds of hours playing a game, you have time to level up. Whereas if it's like, okay, Seamus, you've got 30 minutes and you really need to understand the core mechanics in 90 seconds, it's a different thing. Plus you've got seven other people that are with you. So and crafting a game that allows your like repeat players or your like gung-ho players to have a good time, but your low-skilled players to not feel like they're being dragged along and vice versa is there's a trick to that.
Yeah. Look, it's such an exciting space in general. And I mean, over the 5 years, do you have a sense of like, has VR been going faster or slower than you expected? I mean, yeah, I think there's been the hype moments, but there's also been the, that's almost a sense of going, well, it should have been further along by now. I mean, you know, what's your sense of how, I guess, both the tech and the reception of the tech has kind of been out there?
I think the promise of it is really strong still, and people who try a good VR experience are blown away by it. I think the industry grew out of its boots a little quicker than it should have, I think, with the Facebook acquisition of Oculus, which is exciting, double-edged sword. Again, it got interest, like it definitely helped us get funded. It allowed us to expand, but it also put a huge amount of pressure on the little one, which is essentially a brand new industry, which had been mired with problems. And I think you had a nexus of batteries, like cheaper sensors, better screens. Like there was a whole lot of stuff that was coming into a convergence. But there were some crazy numbers put out there. But I think what's interesting is to see the use cases kind of click into place, like the setting it up in a location has been really, really successful. Probably one of the more like successful cases in terms of people generating revenue and buzz for their products, which is awesome. I think it's probably where I kind of thought it would get to. I think what we're starting to see as well with Steam VR, which is awesome, is the real risk at the start was a fracturing of like, because you've got this constant, like, you need a platform for people to make content for, but no one's going to make content for a platform that hasn't got penetration. So there's this, like, how do you get that working? And look, all the all-in-one headsets, like the Quest is a really interesting way to get that into people's homes. It's making people have to be pretty, inventive with what makes a great concept that, like, it's a lower, you haven't got the luxury of a PS5 workhorse. You've got a much smaller processing unit. But I think in that standalone space and some of the stuff that will be coming down the pipe with those headsets over the next 2 years is really, really interesting. And I think because it was VR and then it's like, oh no, VR's dead, AR's here. And then that kind of, I think it all blends together. But ultimately, Will it need to be in a pair of glasses before it's popular? Probably not. Like, I think seeing the Quest coming up really well, I think the, I won't say its names, but there's new headsets that are being released soon, that the pre-orders are really strong. I think it's kind of settling in and people are seeing it as an option. There is more content. There's a couple of like tentpole titles out there that are worth getting the headsets for. So I think it's growing probably at the rate that it was always going to grow. But I think some of the hype at the start of, you know, we'll have 100 million headsets was probably a little ambitious.
Yeah. And look, I mean, in some ways it's probably played well for a model like yours where, you know, I think, look, you know, and I've got a setup here in my living room. Like I absolutely kind of thoroughly enjoy playing all sorts of stuff. But there's a palaver to it when you want to kind of flick the switches and get everything. Cause I know, right? Like the light boxes, I can't leave them on because they interfere with the living room infrared system to send signals to the TV. Yeah. So there's all those little things where you're like, oh, okay, you've got to make sure you set everything up just right. And that's something that a lot of people won't necessarily fuss with. And so they're like, oh, to go and have the experience somewhere is kind of more of a trigger for them still until it sort of, you know, next wave of things comes down the line.
And I think that, yeah, that's definitely helped us out as VR's profile has grown. Like we initially was in Melbourne, we opened, I would say 80% of people that came through were tech enthusiasts, people trying to copy us, gamers and VR heads. Like it was, and then, but that's kind of, that shifted over the first sort of 6 to 12 months where we had a great moment where I was staying, watching some sessions and a mother came through with her gamer daughter and two non-gamer daughters. They had a great time and the mum brought her 50-year-old girlfriends back the next month. So, because it is, and I think that's one great thing that VR does generally, but what we've tried to do is make it, like you don't need to be able to play a computer game to play it. You just need to be able to participate in life in a bipedal reality. Like that's kind of, if you can do that, you can play. And I think that's been a really powerful thing, even to an extent where, like, people who are really immersed in video games all the time probably don't like it as much, they still enjoy it, as someone that hasn't played a modern video game in 10 years. Like, I call them the golden, there's a GoldenEye generation that kind of come in, they play GoldenEye, that was, and then they got busy, had families, got jobs, and they come back and go like, oh my God, like, this is incredible. So you're giving them a sort of next-gen gaming experience and VR in free roam with their friends, and that's a really powerful thing. Though I do think we've spoiled VR at home for a generation of people who are like, what do you mean I can't walk? I only can walk two steps.
Yeah.
you know. But I think it's to your point around the lighthouses setting up, like, that is definitely an impediment. And I think that's where the SLAN tracking all-in-ones, and whether you just need one killer app, like Beat Saber's a great game,
yeah,
and it hits that perfect mix. It's quick to learn, hard to master, it's social, it's time boxed, so you're not having some guy hogging the headset for 45 minutes. Yeah. It's very cool. It's a very such a simple concept. And I think you're going to see more of those, like, stripping it back to basics. And I think also coming up with something that works in the medium versus, oh, I want to make a first person shooter and I'm going to, like, shoehorn it into VR. It's like, no, what's, I've got a VR headset. If I'd never made a video game before, what would I do? Is kind of, and I think that's ultimately where we came at it from, being we'd never made games, we'd never run a business, we just really loved it and saw potential. And there's like, okay, we've got, like, we did some military training, we did some architectural visualization work early in the piece, but it keep coming back to gaming, but going, all right, like, what experience are we making here, and learning as you go, like, putting real people in it and going, oh, it's interesting, like, one player's fun, but two players, oh my God. And when they can talk to each other, oh, hang on, now we're getting somewhere. That social aspect was a lot more important than I gave it credit for in the first year of the project, I would say. It was interesting to see that level up when you start to talk to your friends and when you see your avatar. Like, we had a moment where we, first ever game, you could choose your avatar, even that sort of stuff of getting a more convincing avatar. We had a bear in there for a while, and we had this really interesting trend, because this is early days, we watched every session, so hundreds of the sessions, that when you had a man and a woman in a relationship come in, the man would almost always choose the bear. And it's like, oh, that's really interesting. Like, what's going on there? There's a protective thing in there.
You're right.
Fascinating, it's like, psychology.
Yeah, I was about to say, have you invited some psychologists along to kind of get, come and analyze this?
Yeah. And then people going through and you know, like, men spending longer on the female avatar and then going off it and coming back to it. It's really interesting to see people's role playing. What do they want to do? It's fascinating social experiment. I think that's one of the great things about coming with your friends and you're putting on this headset. So I'm looking at you that are pulling the headset. Oh my God, you're an avatar. We have this really crazy experience. And because, like, most of our games, you travel like hundreds of meters through different environments, so you're super immersed. We switch you around, so you don't really know where you are in the physical space. And you pop out the other end and you lift it up and you're still there. It's a different experience to playing an online game and then logging off and I'm by myself in my house. It's a really interesting continuum of social activity.
I mean, what are the kind of other extensions out there? You know, is it like at some point, do you release the home game, or do you even make a board game of Zero Latency, the board game?
Maybe. Look, there's definitely, I think there's applications what we do in home. The pipeline to get it from, like, how do you make a game that feels as good in free roam as it does in the home is a challenge. Something that we actually got a few prototypes that we're working through to hopefully make that happen. Playing to our sweet spot is really cool. We've got, as an example, I think we've had a few people approach us for this, and hopefully they're still under NDA. There might be a project this year that gets signed off. But it's like, say you want to build a large public space. You've got a lot of stakeholders. Reading plans is difficult. What I can do is go, well, look, why don't I put you in there and you can see how it looks walking through there. Let's put 1,000 people in there. How does it feel? What does it look like when it's summer, winter, high noon? And you can actually put a bunch of stakeholders in a space and experience it, which is a lot easier than like, oh, watch this 30-second 3D fly through that we've watched together. You know, it's a lot more honest than a 3D fly through. We actually did some apartments initially for a developer who remained nameless, and we put the architect in. The architect's like, nah, these apartments are too small. We're like, no, man, like, they're literally to the millimeter. But even the guy designs like, these apartments are pretty little. I'm like, yeah, man, because they're little. Like, that's what you built. Like, it's, your VR's broken. It's like, the VR ain't broken, yeah. Friend. This is just a really little apartment. So needless to say, it wasn't a great advertising tool for that market. But yeah. for larger scale public spaces where you're spending, the stakes are high and you're spending a lot of money and you need to convince everybody that, no, this giant, you know, auditorium or this giant atrium is going to look amazing. It's a really, really good tool for selling the dream on those larger things, I think.
Mm. So I guess to wrap up, you know, what is your, you know, your thought on, you know, like what's the next leap forward in a sense for some of this?
For VR generally, yeah. Or for
well, you know, I guess for both VR generally and for the kind of experience you hope to be able to, you know, keep giving people or
I really hope, like seeing the zero latency sort of side out of it, that I just hope that there is that we keep seeing people taking risks and experimenting with the whole XR suite. Like, I think to your point before, there was hype and disillusionment. Like, it's a very different thing. It's not an iPad. It's not a computer. It's not a Game Boy. It's a very different medium, and it has some really powerful uses. It has some stuff it doesn't do well. And I just hope that as we see headset prices come down, like the Quest 2 is a pretty cost-effective unit for what it delivers. As we see more standalone headsets come into the market and they ramp up, I just hope that people keep taking risks and investing in it, because I think there's some really compelling, like, shining light use cases out there. I think zero latency is one. I think a Beat Saber is one. It's like, no, you can make something compelling that's a business out of this, and that people keep showing up and trying that, and making sure that we don't end up with a series of little walled gardens. Like Facebook going, oh, now you're going to have a Facebook account. It's like, oh, man, can't we just all like give it, like let's let it bloom before we start chopping it up and working out how we portion it up. So I think I'm hoping it stays open and experimental for a little while longer, because I think that's what it needs, just a little more time to breathe, like a fine wine, which I think will hopefully happen, because it's not, there's enough players in the market that are interested in it that it will keep developing, I think.
Yeah. All right. So give us the rundown. When does Sydney open? And then what are all the other Australian locations that people can find?
Sydney's tickets are on sale now and starting to move quickly, which is awesome. So jump in, opens on the 1st of December. It's a great place to go with your family, with your work colleagues, whether you like your family or not. Just choose your game. Do you want to work with them or fight against them? solve your disputes pre-Christmas lunch. So that's open in Sydney, and we're in Perth, Sydney, Melbourne, the Gold Coast and Brisbane.
Awesome.
So get on down. Yeah.
Tim, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.